But we're going to go ahead and do the church at Philadelphia, which is Revelation, wrong end of the book, Revelation chapter 3, verses 6 through 13. And I will read from my translation. "And to the angel of the church in Philadelphia you shall write, thus says the holy, the true, the one having the key of David, the one opening and no one will shut, and shutting and no one opens. I have known your works. Behold, I have given before you a door that is opened, which no one can shut it, because you have small ability and you have kept my word and didn't deny my name. Behold, I give out of the synagogue of Satan the ones calling themselves to be Jews, and they are not, but they falsify. Behold, I shall make them so that they shall be present and worship before your feet and know that I loved you. Because you kept the word of my patience, I also shall keep you out of the hour of the testing about to come upon the whole house of the world to test the dwellers upon the earth. I come quickly. Hold what you have so that no one shall take your crown. The one conquering, I will make him a pillar in the temple of my God, and he shall not outside go out. Yet also I shall write upon him the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, the New Jerusalem, the one coming down out of the heaven from my God and from my new name." "The one having an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches." So, very briefly, like I said, we'll do an abridged version tonight. And this should be a shorter passage to cover because we'll get to why. But what do we have tonight? What are some major observations you guys have from the text about the church in Philadelphia? Yeah, absolutely. No rebuke, no word of criticism or condemnation at all in this text. Everything we hear about the church is positive. Now, I will say this. There's one place where people try to find a criticism, and I think it's ridiculous. In fact, I did not know that people even did that until I was reading today. But where he says, you have little strength or you have small ability. Yeah, so your take is, you know, that was not a criticism, them having little strength, but they were relying on the strength of God, I really like the way you're going with that too, because when you're saying that their strength came from God, them having little strength isn't a rebuke, is going to be very important when we compare them to the church at Laodicea, where the church at Laodicea says, you know, I'm rich, wealthy, I don't need a thing, and obviously they don't. So I think that's a really good observation. Nice job. Other things that we notice about this text here. Okay, so maybe, and honestly, I don't really know much at all about the congregation when John is writing. There's really nothing in the literature that I saw that would explain why they were a church of little strength. And it's interesting that you bring that up too, because the church in Philadelphia has existed as a major church all the way until the Seljuk Turks conquered that area in, I think, the 13th century. And it is believed that there are still Christians who live in this area to this day. Now, they live secretly, they live underground, but there was a continuous church all the way until the time of the fall of the Eastern Roman Empire in that area. So they long outlasted, even though they were a church of very little strength, they were a church that outlasted others by over 1,000 years. I mean, some of the churches here died off pretty quickly. Ephesus did. But others were very strong and lasted. Other things, anything else we observe, like big picture stuff from the text? Yes, this church is promised that they will be kept from the hour of testing. Now, Connie Jacoby asked, I think it was last week, asked about the Great Tribulation and asked about the rapture. And this is, we'll talk about it really briefly. We won't talk about it a lot, but generally that has been interpreted by people who believe in a pre-tribulation rapture, as that statement is saying, you are going to be kept out. That's a strong verse used to support the pre-tribulation rapture. We'll talk a little bit more about that when we get there, but yet you're right. It's the only church that receives that promise. And so, again, we have this issue of, well, why didn't the other ones, are these promises to these churches, are they exclusive to that particular church, or are these churches, because they're representative of all churches through all ages, are they also speaking to all churches? Are they, you know what I mean? So it gets a little bit complicated, but you're right, that these faithful ones, and again, well, no, we'll get to, well, no, let's say it now. So because this church is a very faithful church, people have used that argument to say, well, no, only the really faithful are preserved out of the tribulation entirely. People that are less faithful, they have to face some of the tribulation. And so people would look at Philadelphia being kept completely out, and they would say, well, the faithful Christians, they're taken completely out. They're raptured first. And then, you know, that's the partial trib rapture, which I think Dr. Hitchcock talks about at some length in his book. But, yeah. Does that make sense? That kind of address? Okay. Gene, you have something? I believe this is the first mention of the New Jerusalem, and obviously we're going to get a lot in chapters 21 and 22, but yes, this is, I believe so. And I believe that it's, in fact, I think it's the only mention of the New Jerusalem until we get to the end of Revelation as well. So it's, in fact, a lot of the, I'm glad you mentioned that. That's a really good observation, because a lot of the commentators, they note that the language used to describe the Church of Philadelphia is really weird, because Philadelphia, unlike a lot of the other churches, the description of Jesus is not found in the previous mentions that we see about Jesus. We see Jesus claims to be the one holding the keys of David. Well, Jesus is pictured as having the keys of death and Hades before, but not holding the keys of David. And so we see other things like the New Jerusalem. We see everything we see in the church in Philadelphia seems to be kind of new and novel. It doesn't seem to have precedent already in the revelation of Jesus that we've already received from John, when John sees him and then describes him, which is really strange, because all the other churches do, even the church in Smyrna, which was another church that didn't have any condemnation, they were using, that John is using descriptions about Jesus that have a precedent before there. So it really stands out like a sore thumb when you're looking for things like that. So that's a really good observation, by the way, about that. And it's, you wonder what the significance of that is, and I really don't know. If you figure it out, let me know, and then I'll write an article about it, and then everybody will think I'm smart. But thank you. Oh, yes, great question. What is the key of David? The key of David is, if you have your Bible, turn to Isaiah chapter 22. Isaiah chapter 22. And you're going to... You may be a little disappointed when we get there, but in Isaiah 22, there's a prophecy about Jerusalem, and chapter 22, verse 22, I'm going to begin in verse 20, and the Lord is saying, "In that day I will summon my servant Eliakim, son of Hilkiah. I will clothe him with your robe and fasten your sash around him, and hand your authority over to him. He will be a father to those who live in Jerusalem and to the people of Judah. I will place on his shoulder the key to the house of David. What he opens, no one can shut, and what he shuts, no one can open. I will drive him like a peg into a firm place. He will become a seat of honor for the house of his father. All the glory of his family will hang on him, its offspring and offshoots, all of its lesser vessels and the bowls of all the jars. And that day, declares the Lord Almighty, the peg driven into the firm place will give way, it will be sheared off and will fall, and the load hanging on it will be cut down, says the Lord." So this prophecy that we see, Isaiah is speaking about what's going to happen. We're not going to read all of chapter 22, but he's talking about what's going to happen in the days of Israel's trouble. And he's saying that he's going to raise up this guy, Eliakim, and he is going to have access to the wealth that David has, that God is going to raise him up, and he is going to be somebody that the Israelites rely upon. The Judeans and the remaining Levites and the sons of Aaron, they're all going to rely on him. And just like, you know, you could drive a peg into a wall and you could put your shelving on it, eventually Eliakim is going to fall. He's going to shear off and everything that hangs on him is going to break. Jesus, however, in chapter 3, he's described this way. He says, the holy, the true, the one having the key of David, the one opening and no one shuts, and shutting and no one opens. But Jesus is described as being the eternal one. Jesus is the one who gives eternal life. And so there's this interesting contrast between Eliakim, who is prophesied as being one who has the key of David, but he's going to fall off, he's going to break off, he's going to perish. And now we have Jesus, who's the eternal one, who obviously is not going to perish. I also forgot it started at 6 tonight, so everybody was rightly teasing me. So I will try to remember. So you haven't missed much. So the key of David, it appears to be that the key of David, some people would say, is access to riches and wealth. Other people interpret it as having access to leadership. I think that it's a reference primarily to authority. To David was the king. David had authority. We see a passage previously about Eliakim that he becomes the leader of his people. And so I think what he's saying is, when we take the overall context of the Church of Philadelphia, as Deanne pointed out, is a weak church. They have little strength. They have some strength, but they have little strength. And they are facing severe opposition from other Jews. And so it's not a coincidence that there's the Jews in the synagogue of Satan, and then Jesus is reminding them that he is the Jewish king, he is the Jewish Messiah, and he's telling them, what I open, no one can shut. What I shut, no one can open. And so even though they're facing opposition, they're facing what appear to be nothing but closed doors to the gospel and to their mission, and people keep trying to close doors against them, and their enemies constantly have doors opening. He's saying, I'm the one that's really in charge. I'm the one that has all sovereignty. So that's kind of where I go on that. But that's the right answer. You know, that's where I go. That's the right way to go. But other major things we notice or big questions we have about the text before we dive into it? I mentioned you just a little bit ago, Connie, because there's a piece here that talks about the tribulation. So we'll come to that in a little bit. And So like I said, this will be rather short tonight because the church at Philadelphia does not have a lot of background information that is relevant to the text. It's very interesting because this is one of, like I said, it's one of the most long-lived churches. It existed at least until the 12th, 13th centuries, and then we there's good reason to believe that Christians have lived in a secret way even up until the present day in that area of Turkey. But it's interesting that there's very little that gives us a hint that this was written to the actual historical city. So Philadelphia was basically a Greek colony by the time that we come here. The name Philadelphia means brotherly love. It was named after one of the kings of the native Turkish kings who lived there. They were the Phrygian king. And I forget his name, Attalus? I don't remember exactly his name, but he had the nickname Philadelphus because he loved his brother with great devotion. And so the city, when the Greek colony moved there, was named after him in honor of him because of his brotherly love. So it was called Philadelphia. The city was a very, very old city, and it was one of the fortress cities in Turkey. So you remember a few weeks ago we were talking about the city of Pergamum and how Pergamum and Thyatira were both basically like fortress cities that defended Ephesus. They were basically kind of places that you had to stop and you had to defeat those cities before you could finally make it to Ephesus. Well, Philadelphia is even further out, and Philadelphia is basically set at it's considered the door to that area of Turkey. It's the door of Lydia, I think, is what people used to call it. So that reference to being a door is also significant because the open door. So Philadelphia was a fortress city, and it was placed there basically because if you wanted to attack Pergamum, Thyatira, and Ephesus, which were the three great cities over there, you had to go through Philadelphia first. It lived on a very fertile plain. There's a lot of volcanic soil there, and grapes are especially good, and so people, they had great wine, and so they worshiped the god Bacchus, which is, you know, I guess if you're going to worship pagan gods, that's not the worst one to worship, but they did, and they worshiped Bacchus, and and even some of their coinage has Bacchus on it, but really, it was a city that was, there's really nothing much in there that is especially important, except for one thing, which is that it was and continues to be a very earthquake prone city. The city was destroyed, completely leveled over and over and over again by earthquakes. And there was a habit, however, if you look at the way ancient buildings were constructed, the ancient Greek construction style was basically just, you know, columns, pillars with lintels on top, and then they would, you know, it's kind of that very simple construction style. Well, after earthquakes would fall, sometimes the pillars would be the only thing that stand. So everything else would come crumbling down, but the pillars would continue to stand. And so we'll see later that will have some significance. But other than that, nothing really major in the cultural history of Philadelphia to talk about. So let's just dive right into the text. We have our standard greeting to the angel, that is the pastor of the Church of Philadelphia. You shall write, thus says the holy, the true, the one having the key of David, the one opening and no one will shut, and shutting and no one opens. Now, we've already spoken about that, we've talked about that passage before, that the key of David, I believe, is having the authority, having total sovereignty. David was a king. Jesus is referred to as many places as the son of David. He's the root and offspring of Jesse. I think that's what he's saying, and we'll see later why that's significant, because the church at Philadelphia was not a strong church. And there's, if you look, I've got a note here, and it says, note the transition from the future tense to the present. So that's something that you probably might have skipped over, and I've skipped over, and I'm really glad that I wrote myself that note, because he says, the one opening and no one will shut. That's not a statement of, like, that's not a declarative statement like we'll use in English. Like in English, we'll say, well, no one will shut that. And we don't necessarily mean that to carry a future tense meaning, but it does mean that here. And so here it says, no one will shut it. He's saying that no one's going to shut anything in the future, but in the present tense, he's shutting things and no one opens anything that he's shutting. So I don't know that there's anything greatly significant about that, but again, it refers to the universality and the eternality of his power. If Jesus shuts it, not only is it shut, but it will always be shut. If Jesus opens it, not only is it open, but it will always be open, or at least it will be open as long as he says so, because he may choose to shut it. He may choose to open something that's shut. Jesus has that ability, which is something that we've seen in the church at Ephesus, right? He warns the church at Ephesus. He's the one who walks about the golden lampstands, and he warns them, I will snuff out your lampstand if you are not doing what you should be doing. And then we have verse 8, I have known your works. So again, this is another instance where Jesus knows their works. Now, we haven't seen I know your works in every single one of these churches, but we see it here with Ephesus. But then we have this strange statement. He says, I have known your works. And normally we see a commendation about the works themselves, but he doesn't here. He follows up with, I have known your works. Behold, I have given before you a door that is open, which no one can shut it. Because you have small ability, you have little strength, and you have kept my word and didn't deny my name. So that's really odd, because it's, again, it's breaking the patterns from what we've seen before. I do not have a good answer on this. I'm just, you know, fishing for ideas. Do you guys have any ideas on why he would break the pattern and go from, I've known your works, and then not describe the works that they have, and then talk about how he's putting an open door before them? Okay, so maybe the works, the only works they were able to do is to bear up under persecution patiently, not deny his name, and that's really what's being put there. I think that's probably a pretty strong possibility. Everybody thinks they're right, right? Here's the only critique I have of that idea, because I think that makes a lot of sense. But why do we have the statement again about the open door that he set before them if their only work is not denying his name? It would seem like if he's saying that their works are that they didn't deny his name, and they've kept his word too. the thing about the door being open and the open and shut doors should come after the commendation that they have kept his word and didn't deny his name? Or are you saying, go ahead. Yeah, all these churches were pretty greatly persecuted. Okay. I don't disagree with that. Yeah. Well, you know, okay, so maybe and running off of that idea, I'm starting to warm to that idea. Maybe you are right. I'm not ready to say you're entirely right, but maybe you're right. No, I think you're convincing me, because what he seems to be saying is, I've set before you a door that's open, which no one can shut it because you have small ability. And he says, because you're weak and you haven't denied me. I'm just gonna paraphrase it. So to paraphrase, he's saying, I know your works. Look, I'm giving you opportunities. I'm giving you opportunities out of my sovereignty, because despite your weakness, you've kept the faith. So it looks as though, if going with your interpretation that keeping the word and not denying the name are the works that the church in Philadelphia had, that what he's now going to do is he's going to reward their faithfulness because they bore up under persecution. Now he's opening doors for them, and he's going to allow them to have an effective witness so that they can do more works. Does that make sense to you? Okay. Yeah, I think you've convinced me. I think that's probably right, so. Okay, let's hear it. Okay. We already agreed Brian's right. So if your idea, let's see if. Okay, no, I think that makes perfect sense. So just for anybody who's listening at home, what Deanne just said is, in the other churches where he says, I know your works, and they receive a rebuke, he's saying, I know your works, you've done ABC, but you've done this bad thing, which kind of negates the good things you've done. But here, because they haven't done bad things, there's no need for an exhaustive list of all the good things they've done. Jesus doesn't need to make a compliment sandwich like he's, you know, a middle manager at a paper company. You know, he can just go directly to the promises that he's given them. So I think you're probably right, and I think probably you and Brian can both be right here. I think those things are completely simpatico, copacetic. I think those are not competing but complementary interpretations here. So thank you guys. That's awesome, because I was really not sure about that, and I like those interpretations. And then we've got another behold. So getting into verse 9. Let me just take a quick pause. Does anybody else have any comments or questions? Okay. So getting at verse 9, we've got our second behold. Behold, I give out of the synagogue. Now, I mentioned this before, but this out of, you're going to get really tired of reading it when you read my translation because it's kind of clunky, but I want you to notice the way that John uses that expression in Greek, because I'm being very literal, and you'll see that John is, you'll kind of get a feel for the way John is saying this and the way Greek works, but he's saying, behold, I give out of the synagogue the ones calling themselves to be Jews, and they're not, but they falsify, and then another behold, and it's, he says, behold, I give. So basically he's saying, look, I give. You give to whom? Giving is a verb that you have to have a recipient somehow, right? You're giving to whom? And it seems to be implied, I'm giving them to you. And so we have verse 9 really is kind of an incomplete sentence. He's saying, behold, I give out of the synagogue the ones calling themselves to be Jews, and they're not, but they falsify. Behold, I give them. I shall make them so that they shall be present and worship before your feet and know that I loved you. So we have this kind of incomplete sentence. It's almost as though Jesus is falling over his words, saying this to them. It's really a strange way of saying it. Notice I put a note there on the word falsify. That is a different word from the word lie that we typically see in the New Testament. So this word is pseudomai. That's where we get the word pseudo, pseudo. Well, I mean, we use it all the time, right? So when we talk about something being a false, like a false prophet, a pseudo prophet, or a pseudo messiah, or you know, a pseudo medicine, things like that. So that word is falsify, And the other verb that I translate as lie throughout John's literature and throughout the Revelation is the verb planao. Planao. So if you think that I'm just being really weird by using this fancy, clunky English, I'm distinguishing between the falsify here, which, again, when you use the word false prophet, false messiah, things like that in the biblical literature, it's always prefixed by pseudo. So it's this idea of not only are they liars, but they're false. They're pretending to be something. They're hypocrites. It's something that can deceive you, right? Like, you know, a pseudo medicine or a pseudo science. I think that's probably where we hear the word most. A pseudo science is something pretending to be something else, and that people could fall for. It's a trick, and I mean, lie can work that way too. But that's kind of what's going on here. Is he's saying that these people who claim to be Jews, they're pseudo Jews. They're not really Jews. They're pseudo Jews because a real Jew, a person who is actually a child of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, they would be worshiping me. They would be a complete Jew. And Paul talks about this, right? Paul says not everybody who is Israel is Israel. You know, just because you're, John the Baptist says, you know, don't tell me you're sons of Abraham because God can raise up children for Abraham out of these stones, which is interesting because, you know, Gentiles then become children of Abraham by adoption. But we're getting way ahead of ourselves, Lukey here. So the synagogue of Satan, what is the synagogue of Satan? I'll throw that back to you guys. What do you think that means? Yeah, no, I mean, that's a pretty standard interpretation. One of them is that, you know, these people are claiming to be Christians, but they're not even Christians. They're a synagogue of Satan. So that's one of the standard interpretations. Any other ideas what that could mean? I don't know. I don't think it's a physical place. At least if it was a physical place, we don't have any knowledge of it. But again, you know, Philadelphia was destroyed by war and earthquakes. And actually, when the Turks took over the city, they pretty much leveled the city as well. So there's very little that exists archaeologically from the ancient city. So Jesus could be making tons of references to the ancient city, and we simply wouldn't know it because there's very little that's survived from the ancient world. That we could confirm. But yeah, it could be a real place. There could be a place that was called by the people. It could have been a notoriously bad synagogue or church where people had maybe fallen into pagan worship, because a lot of times Satan is identified in the New Testament. Satan and demons are identified with pagan worship. You know, Bacchus, you know, sometimes... Well, not Bacchus particularly, but Bacchus is often associated with the god Pan, and Pan is the little horned goat boy, you know. So possibly it could be something like that. The standard interpretation is that these are Jews who are persecuting the church because the Jews often were at the head of the persecution of Christians. And there was we do have reason to believe there was a large Jewish population in the city of Philadelphia around this time. And so this would be right in keeping with what we see in other cities, at least in Paul's travels, where the Jews were the most ferocious persecutors of the church, and they often stirred up trouble with the Roman authorities. So those are basically your interpretations, is the synagogue of Satan could be corrupted believers, but that's unlikely. And the reason that's unlikely is because Jesus is normally speaking to the church as a whole, to all the believers in the city. So if there are believers in the city who are people who are claiming to be Christians in the city who are falling into paganism, normally Jesus would address that, right? So while that's possible that he could be saying, like, no, you guys have completely broken away from the false believers, and so I'm not condemning you with them, it seems unlikely because that we would think that might have come up in a commendation for them, that you, because we've seen that in, is it the church in Smyrna where he says you don't tolerate the woman Jezebel, and there are other people who, they can't stand the teaching, the Ephesians can't stand the teaching of the Nicolaitans. So if it were that, we would expect to see something in the text. So then the other two options are the synagogue of Satan could be pagan worship, or it could be a just Jewish opposition. I think the best answer is Jewish opposition, because he's saying they're calling themselves Jews. They're not Jews, at least they're not true Jews, but they call themselves Jews and they're a synagogue of Satan, which tells you, again, what Jesus thinks of Judaism minus Jesus. Like, Judaism without Jesus is satanic. Now that Messiah has been revealed, to reject Messiah is satanic, which, you know, is strong words, but, you know, Jesus, you know, he created the universe, so he can do some tough talk when he feels like it. So, and particularly when they're persecuting the church, when they're persecuting God's people, Jesus tends to take off the gloves. And so then we get this really fascinating statement at the end of verse 9, verse 9b. He says, Behold, I shall make them so that they shall be present. We've seen that word be present before, right? Like when Jesus threatens, he says, I will be present before you. I will be present upon you. He's basically saying, I'm going to make them show up and worship before your feet and know that I loved you. Now that expression, worship before their feet, I have a note in my translation that I make later, but that expression, worship before your feet, we see that when John falls down and worships before the feet of the angel, like he does it before one of the elders, and the elder says, don't do it. He does it before one of the angels, and the angel says, don't do it. And then the people do it before Jesus, and Jesus receives their worship, because this expression, to worship before somebody's feet, in the revelation of John means to actually give them worship, which is really weird, right? So one of two things is happening here, as far as I can tell. Either John is consistently using the expression, I will make them worship before your feet. Either the expression worship before your feet has two meanings, and it normally means worship, but it can also mean worship around somebody, like not necessarily give them worship, but to worship in their proximity. Or Jesus is saying, I'm going to make unbelievers turn you into an object of worship. What do we do with that? What do you guys think it means? It's kind of sounds like a trick question. I promise it's not a trick question. I spent a lot of the day going back and forth on this one. I'm like, which way does it go? Okay, so this phrase, I shall make them worship before your feet. It could mean two things. One, it could mean Jesus is going to make them worship, presumably himself, around you. Like Jesus is saying, you know, Gene has been so righteous and so holy that he's going to make Deanne, the godless Deanne, get down and worship before his feet. But Deanne's going to be worshiping Jesus, which is what it could mean, except every other place where this expression worship before your feet is used, it means worship the one before whose feet you're standing. So, like I said, when people worship before the feet of the elders are like, no, don't do it. When they worship before the feet of the angel, they say, no, don't do it. The normal use of that expression means that you're worshiping the one before whose feet you stand. So when Jesus says, I'm going to make these godless persecutors worship before your feet, is he saying, I'm going to make them kneel before you and worship me? Or is Jesus saying, I'm going to make them worship you? Okay, so it could be an analogy like that. If it is, so you're suggesting that the analogy means they're going to worship before. So does that mean they're actually going to become believers? That when they have the upper hand, these people are going to become converted? No, I'm with you. I understand the tension, because if this was any other issue, I would look at it and say, just looking at the way the word is, looking at the way the expression is used in the New Testament, looking at the natural context of the verse, I would say Jesus is going to make them worship the Philadelphian church. The Philadelphians will be the object of the synagogue of Satan's worship. That is the normal, routine way of interpreting it. But because we also have human beings rejecting and angelic beings rejecting worship in the rest of the text, it kind of creates this tension for us. Now, here's what I propose, is that there are two things that I think we can propose that might resolve this, because I really don't think that it's fair to say that this is a unique expression, and here it means something different than it does every other time it's used in the same 22 chapters. That's a tough case to make. And saying that it's an analogy, it could be an analogy, but again, that's a really hard case to sustain, because it almost seems like a cop-out, because it's like, well, it can't mean what it naturally would seem to mean, and so we're just going to call it a metaphor. And so this is an issue that happens a lot in Bible study and Bible interpretation, is we come to a passage like this, and it's really difficult. And the temptation is to give an answer that's good enough, even though we know it has problems, and say, well, we don't know what the answer is, but this is good enough, so we're going to just say that that's what it is. I really push back against that idea. Not because it's perfectly okay with me to say, hey, look, we're going to say that this is analogy because we don't have a better answer for right now. This is the best answer we have for now, but I'm not comfortable going any further. But there's probably a better answer. I'm okay with saying that, with giving a provisional answer. I'm okay with saying, look, maybe it's just a different use of, it's just a non-routine use of this verse. Maybe he's saying it for contrast. Maybe he's using it to create an identification of the church with Jesus. So when they worship Jesus, they're worshiping them, or they're worshiping Jesus through them. Maybe, but again, there are known problems with that. Like, we know that there are problems. So all we're doing is we're switching one set of problems for another set. And so what I want when I'm looking at difficult passages is, I want an answer that solves all the problems. I want an answer that resolves everything, that doesn't create another set of problems. And the closest I can come is this. I have two ideas on this. One is that there is a theory, and I think it's a very good theory, that comes out of the Eastern Orthodox Church, and it's called divinization. Or it's basically a way of understanding, when we are given our new bodies, God is glorifying us, and we are forever going to become more like Jesus. God is always going to give us more glory and more power and more authority. And in so doing, maybe we become justifiable objects of worship. Not saying that's a good answer, but that's a possible answer. But there's really nothing to support that. So it doesn't have any problems with it, you know, from the text, but it's like really hard to sustain. The other one is this, and this is where I think is probably the right answer, is if we look at this verse where he says, "Behold, I shall make them so that they shall be present and worship before your feet, and know that I loved you." We normally think of those things as two different things. So if we were going to diagram this, you'd have like a straight line until where he says, "I will make them worship before your feet." And then another idea, a parallel idea, is that they will know, or I think probably your King James, Deanne says, acknowledge that I have loved you, or something like that. I don't think these are two separate ideas. There's something called an exegetical clause. I'm giving you the fancy name for it, so if you ever hear another pastor use it, you know what it is. I think that know or acknowledge that I have loved you is the explanation of what it means for them to worship before their feet. I think that it's actually pretty close to what you said. The tables are going to be turned. I don't think it's an allegory. I don't think it's an analogy. I think the tables are turned. I think he's talking about the final judgment, or it could be in this world too. But definitely at the final judgment, when every knee bows and every tongue confesses that Jesus Christ is Lord, and these people look at the saints in glory, these people that they persecuted, these people that they may have taken part in stoning or beating or murdering or robbing or raping or torturing, and they look at them and they see these saints in glory. They see them glowing with this like Moses glow, and they worship them, and the content of their worship is, Jesus really did love them. We who were Jews, we hated them, but Jesus loved them, and that's why they are in this glorified state, and we are going to eternal misery. Now, it's a theory. Maybe it really is just a metaphor. Maybe it really is just strong talk. But that, I think, solves all the problems. Now, it could be wrong. There's no way for me to prove it, but I think that's the best solution to this text. But even that, a lot of people would push back hard against that and say, like, no, like, even worshiping other people like that would be a sinful act. And why would Jesus make them worship them. Well, doesn't Jesus direct worship to the Father? Why can't Jesus say, no, I want you to worship my saints. I want you to glorify them. I want you to give them honor and praise and speak highly of their worth. I sound very uncertain tonight, but there's a lot of stuff that is uncertain. But does anybody, I know I'm going a little bit over time. Does anybody want to push back on that? Does anybody think I'm, any more further comments on that? Good as answer as any. You know what? I'm gonna take good as answer as any and run with it, because I think that's about as good as I can do on that one. But it is whatever it is. It's a beautiful promise. I think at a minimum we can say that it's a beautiful promise. And like I think Deanne, you and Brian both were saying that whatever this means, it means that things are going to turn out all right for these believers who are suffering. Jesus is going to make it right, and Jesus is going to make sure that those who hated them are going to know that Jesus makes it right. And again, look at this emphasis on I loved you. That's deliberate. That's in Greek, that is an emphasis of I have loved you. He's saying that's important. And then he says, and I have loved you. And then because you kept the word of my patience. Now this is a new thought. That because does not mean is not relying on the I loved you. He's not saying that I have loved you because you kept the word of my patience. He's saying know that I have loved you. That is connected to the previous passage. This is a hard break in verse 10. This is a brand new idea. Because you kept the word of my patience, I also shall keep you out of the hour of testing and come upon the whole house of the world to test the dwellers upon the earth. I come quickly, hold what you have so that no one shall take your crown. So we have this statement that there's going to be an hour of testing. It is going to come on the whole world. And it is going to come, but he's telling this church, I'm going to keep you out of it. Now, people who say that the church will not be raptured before the Great Tribulation, they will say that this means I will keep you through the hour. I'll keep you out of it, saying that they're saying that, well, I'll take you out of it. Like, you'll go through it, and then I'll take you out of it. No, sorry. That's not how Greek works. That's not how prepositions work. He is clearly saying in the context of Revelation, I am going to take you out of it so you will not experience it. Now, I think that this is one of the best pieces of internal evidence that there is, that there will be a pre-tribulation rapture. Now, you could say that, well, it was true for the Church of Philadelphia because they're all dead. And so he did keep them out of that time. I mean, yeah, but I think that these letters to the seven churches are speaking to the church universally through all of time. And so I think what he's saying is faithful believers in Jesus Christ will be kept from the hour of tempting. We will, like I said, we'll talk about this more when we get into chapter 4, because that'll be the natural time to talk about it. But notice what he calls it, the hour of testing. That word testing is the verb is peirazō, and I've talked about the verb peirazō before. It can mean to tempt or it can mean to test. So it's a really difficult word. It has a lot of nuance to it. You really have to look at the context. But he's saying, I'm gonna come and I'm gonna test the house of the world and the dwellers upon the earth. And actually, I found today another commentator, like somebody who's good at this, not just me, notice the difference between the dwellers on the earth and those who dwell in heaven. So somebody else notices that there is that thing going on. Anyways, he says, I come quickly, hold what you have. Notice that hold what you have. He's not saying grasp for more. He's not saying, go crazy. He's put before him an open door, but he's saying, hold on to what you have. This is another reference to their patience. Hold what you have. You've kept my word. You didn't deny my name. Look at that. He says in verse 8, you kept my word. Verse 10, you kept my word. The word of my patience, my patient word maybe, or my instruction, my command for you to be patient. And then he says, hold what you have. So there's definitely a sense, even though I think it's fairly explicit, but it's definitely a sense here that this is not a strong church. This is not a church that's powerful. This is a church that's under a lot of pressure. And Jesus is basically saying, I know you're weak. I know that you're small in number. I know that you're not wealthy. I know that you're not influential. I know that you're being persecuted. I'm not asking you to go out and rock the world. I'm asking you to bear up under the temptations and the trials you're under. Because guess what? The trials and temptations that you're facing, the testing you're facing, the world is going to face a much worse testing. And I'm going to take you out of that. And so I think that we have this idea. And then, going back, I know, Gene, you and Brian were both kind of pushing on this a couple weeks ago, so that no one shall take your crown. So that seems to imply that someone can take their crown. And what is the crown? Is the crown symbolic of their salvation? Is the crown symbolic of the rewards of the saved? I don't know. We're gonna have to see that. But we're gonna notice later in chapter 6, chapters 4 especially, we're gonna see crowns become significant there. And maybe we'll get a better idea about what crowns are. But we have this issue, and I said it last week, I'll say it again. John in Hebrews does this. John does this, and a lot of the Gospels do this. Peter does this. Paul doesn't. Paul is really strong on once saved, always saved. But these other guys are like, hey, like, you might think you're saved, but maybe you're not. Like, Jesus is not trying to comfort people with the doctrine of eternal security, apart from John 6 and a few other places where John does. But he's saying, like, hey, someone might take your crown. Someone might take your crown, which is a warning to them. Like, keep the faith. Don't abandon the faith, which is right in keeping with what we see in the rest of John's writing, right? So 1 John ends with, children, keep yourselves from idols. 1 John ends with a saying, like, there is a sin that leads unto death. I'm not saying you should pray about that, but you should pray about sins that don't lead unto death. And so John is emphasizing, don't apostatize. Don't fall away from the faith. You can lose your crown. You can have your name written out of the book of life, or at least it's implied that you can. So anyways, we have that. And then again, like I said, I'm going to try to move quickly because I was late starting tonight. But we have this routine ending. The one conquering, I will make him a pillar in the temple of my God, and he shall not. So he's a double negative for emphasis in Greek. It doesn't negate the negative. It emphasizes the negative. He will never go outside. Yet also I shall write upon him the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, the New Jerusalem. Gene, you made a great observation that this is the first reference to the New Jerusalem. We won't see it again until the end. The one coming down out of the heaven from my God and my new name. So this pillar, I mentioned earlier, Mark and Connie, you guys weren't here yet, but Philadelphia was a city that was very earthquake prone. And there are actually some ancient pillars. I think there are one or two ancient pillars that are still standing from the Greco-Roman period, where throughout all the earthquakes, those pillars would stand. So even after a great earthquake, it would be strange because all of the top of the construction would fall down because that was the part that would be shaken off, or it would break, it would shatter because, you know, stone is stronger in compression than tension. But the pillars would continue to stand. And so what he's telling these people living in this earthquake place, where after this earthquake that levels the city, the only thing still standing are the pillars. And he's telling them, this is the first mention we've seen of the tribulation so far too. He's saying, there's testing coming upon the world. I'm going to shake the world. And you guys are going to be the only ones left standing when I shake the world. You guys are going to be the only ones that survive what's going to come upon the world, are those who are overcomers, those who are faithful to me. And they're not only pillars. They're not pillars in some pagan temple to Bacchus or to Pan or to Asclepius or any of these other pagan gods. He's a temple in the temple of my God. So, again, I promise I'm going to try to hurry here. But notice the repetition of my God. Jesus, who is clearly presented as God, is referring to the Father as my God. Jesus does this throughout John's literature. Behold, I ascend to your God and to my God. And so we see this over and over again. He's going to write the name of his God and the name of the city of my God. Over and over and over, Jesus is referring to the Father as my God. Now, this sounds like Jesus is lowering his position, right? It sounds like Jesus is lowering himself, saying that he's beneath the Father, that the Father is somehow a super-duper God and Jesus is a lesser God. That's not what's happening, because what we're going to see later is that all authority in heaven and earth is given to whom? To the Son. The Father gives all authority to the Son, and the Son takes superiority. It's the Son who's the only one who is able to open the seven seals. We'll see that when we get to the seven seals, right? He is the only one. So right now, he calls him the Father. He is my God. And so it appears right now that Jesus is inferior to the Father. But later, we're going to see that the Father gives all authority to the Son. And so we see this interesting reversal where Jesus then becomes not greater than the Father, but Jesus becomes the one who has all authority. Right now, it appears that God the Father is the one who has all authority, but later he is going to give all authority to the Son. We could probably talk about that quite a while, but we're not going to. Again, as Gene mentioned, we have this reference to the New Jerusalem and that it's coming down out of heaven, and then we get the classic conclusion, the one having an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. So in conclusion, this is my conclusion, and then I want to hear you guys' final thoughts before we close up tonight. But the church at Philadelphia, I think the church at Philadelphia sounds an awful lot like a lot of small churches in America. I think the church at Philadelphia reminds me a lot of First Brethren, right? I look around this room, not a lot of people here. I mean, we're not strong, we're not powerful, we're not well, you're rich and famous, you know, so I'm not talking about the mouse in your pocket. I'm saying, you know, you're big fancy government official, you know, but I mean, really, none of us are great and powerful movers and shakers in this world. You know, we are believers in rural America. We're not where the hot stuff is going on. You know, nobody's going to ask me or Pastor Logan to, you know, write a book on church growth. You know, we're never going to have TV shows. This church, we're probably never going to, you know, have thousands of people coming in and out. That's just not the time we live in. And this is the difficult thing. And this is what's really hard. And so I promise I will try to hurry this up. But it doesn't matter what we do. Jesus has to open the door. And that can sound really discouraging, because if the Holy Spirit isn't opening doors, then the church isn't going to grow. And if we truly love the lost, if we want to see people not go to hell, we want God to open doors. But the flip side of that is, if God opens a door for us, no one can shut it. The church in Philadelphia was faithful in their weakness, and so God was giving them strength. They were, when every door was slammed in their face, they continued to be faithful. And God says, I'm going to open doors for you. So my word to us, to the weak churches in this country, is keep the faith. Don't deny his name. Don't be discouraged. We need to pray. We need to spend time in prayer that God, that the one who holds the keys of David, would give us an open door. I know you guys have family members that aren't walking with the Lord. I know you have friends that aren't walking with the Lord, and you feel like you're banging your head against the wall because you keep coming to that closed door over and over and over, and you've probably gotten discouraged. I know I have. You get discouraged and you want to give up. And Jesus is saying, don't give up. Don't be discouraged. Keep the faith. And when I decide, and that's the hard part, it's when he decides, but when he decides, he will open the doors, because he's the one who's sovereign. He's the one who has control. Does anybody else have any final thoughts or questions or comments? Okay, great. Thank you guys very much. I appreciate your time. 6 o'clock next Wednesday.